Good morning and welcome. The Free Congregation of Sauk County is a Unitarian Universalist Fellowship and a welcoming congregation. This means that our invitation is to all and that all are welcome here, regardless of race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender expression, or political persuasion. And I think you all know me, but I'm Robin Proud and I'm one of the rotating speakers. Reading from a book called The Upswing by Robert D. Putnam that I'll talk a bit more about. He reminds us that a French aristocrat named Alexis de Tocqueville traveled to America in 1830 to observe this new experiment in participatory government. Keenly aware of the dangers of individualism, a term he coined, Tocqueville was inspired by what he saw in America. Its citizens were profoundly protective of their independence, but through associating widely and deeply, they were able to overcome selfish desires, engage in collective problem solving, and work together to build a vibrant and, by comparison to Europe at that time, surprisingly egalitarian society by pursuing what he called self-interest rightly understood. So I was asked to speak on a topic relevant for this weekend's event. And I was fortunate to be able to come here. The weather, unfortunately, was one day off, but it was still great. And it was obvious that to do the wonderful work in here, it took a community. It took a small community of people on committees and a larger community of people who helped work and raise money and did so many other things. And even yesterday's events, there were many people who worked together for this and brought in folks from the larger community. One thing that makes a community, according to David Brooks, is a shared sense of history, and you definitely have that. And now I got a brainstorm here for our joint meeting with Prairie later this month that we could do something on our past, our future. If someone from here would present something brief, 5 to 10 minutes, something about the restoration, and maybe an excerpt from the great-granddaughter or great-great-granddaughter who sent that letter, that was very impressive, that not only she knew about this background, but there was a challenge in there for us to take this free thinker's mindset into the world where it's needed. So, Will, you'll hear more about that. So I did what I usually do and read a few books. And I'll talk a bit about what community is, why it's important, and provide some hope that it's not too late to rebuild this important attribute of our country and our world. And I hope to hear from you about communities that are important to you. Now, nobody can dispute the breakdown of community that has occurred, at least in this country, in the last 50 years or so. We're all too aware of connections that have been severed and institutions that we no longer trust. And I have some statistics about that in a few minutes, but just a few of the societal ills that have been tied to weakening of community bonds: anxiety, depression and loneliness, alcohol and drug addiction, an overall decrease in physical and mental health, distrust of organizations and individuals, suspicion of education, politics, and science, which then leads to willingness to believe conspiracy theories, domestic violence, public shootings, failure to address issues that affect us all, like climate change. And the books that I refer to today were written in the last several years, but all before the hugely isolating influence of COVID. So what is community? So one of the books that I consulted, this by columnist David Brooks of the New York Times, called The Second Mountain. His main focus here is actually on individual development. He talks about how people, after they've achieved career goals or relationship goals, sometimes feel, is this all there is? And go on to create and climb a second mountain of something that's important to them. But he has some things to say about community. In 2018, he founded a project called Weave, the Social Fabric Project at the Aspen Institute. He says, the idea is to shine attention on the people who are doing the grassroots work of community building and relationship repair. Brooks identifies a decline in the belief that we are all in this together, with a corresponding uptick in valuing personal freedom and material wealth. Some writers set this change in the 1960s, when the baby boomers learned to distrust authority and conformism after Vietnam and Watergate. Others pinpoint the changes in the Reagan era, greed is good and government is the problem. Whenever it started, Brooks writes, many people have lost faith in the great causes and institutions that earlier generations relied on to give life a sense of purpose and meaning. They have lost faith in faith. Actual church attendance has declined by almost half since the early 1960s. Now, this could be really good news for us. When polls are done on religion, the greatest increase in recent years has been among those who answered none. And yet, at least some of these people would like to belong to a community if they knew they could do so without answering to a hierarchy that has disillusioned them. Practically none of them have heard of Unitarian Universalists, let alone freethinkers. So we're not a proselytizing tradition, but I'm sure there are people out there looking for us. Brooks points out that when people are afraid, they slip into crisis mode, tribalism, and simplistic thinking. He says, maybe it's time we began to see this as a war. On the one side are those forces that sow division, discord, and isolation. On the other side are all those forces in society that nurture attachment, connection, and solidarity. It's as if we're witnessing this vast showdown between the social rippers and the social weavers. And here's the hardest part of the war. It's not between one group of good people and another group of bad people. The war runs down the middle of every heart. Most of us are part of the problem we complain about. Most of us have bought into an individualism that causes us to see ourselves as self-sufficient. Many of us buy into a workaholic ethos that leaves us with little time for community. Most of us hew to a code of privacy that leads us to not know our neighbors. Most of us live with technology that aims to reduce the friction in any encounter, and you get used to that mode of living. For instance, you can order food without ever interfacing with a human being. But community life, care for one another, is built on friction, on sticky and inefficient relationships. In exchange, Brooks proposes the code of the neighbor. We are enough. This community has resources and doesn't have to wait for outside groups. Village over self, willingness to inconvenience yourself for the good of the group. Initiating connection, introducing yourself, inviting other people to talk, to have dinner, and so on. 30-year eyes, awareness of the future you want for the community, not just your immediate needs. And here's a tough one. Radical hospitality, treat others with forgiveness and grace rather than judgment. Servant leadership, willingness to take on any task for the good of the group. The least are the most, seeing value in the old, the young, and the marginalized. And the sin is partly my own, he calls it, acknowledging our own selfishness and short-sightedness and continuing to work through it. This last is related to Brooks' belief that personal transformation and social transformation happen simultaneously. When you reach out and build community, you nourish yourself. And you might have had an example of something where you felt like, I just don't feel like going out to this event or this party or this meeting. And then when you, after you do that, you become more energized actually getting connected. So the Weave Project was founded to highlight individuals and groups that are building healthy communities. And here are just a few examples. A woman who lost her dad when she was young and now runs a grief group for children. An amateur boxer who teaches both boxing and life skills to young men. A woman who started a refugee housing organization in Washington, D.C. This kind of program can give us hope and confidence that we don't find in scary headlines. The people that Brooks is highlighting are very local. They begin and grow projects in their own communities. These founders gain a sense of purpose in life with the programs they've started. And one person can start an initiative. Brooks mentions a Black woman in Chicago who had the opportunity to move out of a difficult neighborhood, but at the last minute she chose to stay. She connected with some existing groups. She started by organizing events for teens and then film and discussion nights for adults. Within 2 years, hundreds of people were involved. Food is a great unifier. Many dinner groups exist around the country, including Bubba Can Cook in Texas, where teams compete in barbecuing. So everything doesn't have to be extremely serious all the time. Now, many more examples of community building can be found in this book, A Path Appears, Transforming Lives, Creating Opportunity, by New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof and his wife Cheryl Wu Dunn. They had already written about the problems of isolation in a couple of previous books. They wrote a book called Half the Sky, Turning Oppression into Opportunity for Women Worldwide, that has an international focus. They also wrote a book called Tightrope, Americans Reaching for Hope, which centers on the community in Western Oregon where Nick grew up, which is now a poster child, Eastern Oregon. It's a poster child for every modern ill. In A Path Appears, the authors have assembled dozens of stories of individuals and groups working to change the world. Now, all the authors I refer to today mentioned that human beings are basically altruistic. Small children will reach out to help people. When we do something for others, we feel good. Students who were given money and told to spend it on themselves had positive feelings about the experience, but those who were told to spend it to help someone else reported even higher levels of happiness. People with deep social ties are healthier and live longer. Kristof says, think of giving back not as a dreary means to a tax deduction, but as a chance to inject meaning, wonder, and fun into life. One study showed that people who are generous have lower blood pressure, maybe because they are not stressed out worrying that everyone is trying to take advantage of them. Kristof starts his book with the story of a 9-year-old named Rachel. For her birthday, rather than gifts, she asked people to give money to support clean water in impoverished villages around the world. The response was a bit disappointing. Less than 6 weeks after her birthday, the family was in a terrible car accident. With the little girl in a coma, friends and family began to support and publicize her water initiative. Sadly, Rachel didn't recover, but eventually over $1 million was donated. Rachel's mother was able to travel to Ethiopia to see a village that now had a well out of the generosity started by her daughter. Around the world, Kristof and Wu Dunn single out many programs, for instance, small business opportunities for women, projects to provide books to impoverished American kids, and so on, that are extremely cost-effective. Now, they point out the issue of the God gulf. They wrote, it would help enormously if secular and religious forces were more willing to work together in building opportunity around the world. Both do outstanding work in addressing humanitarian issues, and they could accomplish far more, especially in advocacy, if they work together on issues like domestic poverty. So I'm sure all of you are involved in many groups, but some suggestions that Kristof and Wu Dunn gave us here. Find an issue that draws you in and research it. You might have a specific interest or expertise in gardening, animals, education, business. Check out organizations on websites such as GiveWell that vet charitable groups for their effectiveness and transparency. You don't have to travel the world. There are undoubtedly groups close to home that can use your support. And this book does list dozens of groups at the back. Volunteer, get involved and do something more than just writing checks. And that was one of the things that has been recommended ever since 2016 for those of us who felt helpless to do something. You may have skills in finance, tutoring, or cooking that are valuable, and it's your chance to belong to a new community. Use your voice to spread the word or advocate for those who are voiceless. As mostly middle or upper class educated white people, we have the luxury of speaking up, both locally and online. Now, the last author I'll refer to is Robert Putnam. He became famous over 20 years ago for a book called Bowling Alone. Anyone remember that one? Bowling Alone, because the idea of that was that people used to go to bowling leagues and go to all these different organizations, and that really dropped off. So it was a decline in civic life. Groups like the Lions Club or the Sons of Norway, the PTA, bowling leagues, all experienced huge drop-offs in the later part of the 20th century. And his newest book expands on that work. The full title is The Upswing, How America Came Together a Century Ago, and How We Can Do It Again, and the we is emphasized. Putnam's basic premise and reason for optimism is that although we have some unprecedented challenges today, we have been here before. He says, the United States of the 1870s, 1880s, and 1890s was strikingly similar to today. Inequality, polarization, and new technology were everywhere. As progressivism countered the inequities of the Gilded Age, the country made strides in health, education, safety, and overall well-being. But starting in the 1960s, this trend began to reverse. Many thinkers love to point to a previous golden age, such as the 1950s, and that's the unspoken world of Make America Great Again. There are a couple of problems with this. One is that the era was great if you were white, male, straight, and American-born. And the other is that, according to Putnam, that is too short an arc of history. He claims the changes were not in one direction, rather an ascending and descending path, or maybe a pendulum. So it is not inevitable that they will continue in the same manner. From 1913 to 1970, the U.S. experienced what economic historians Peter Lindert and Jeffrey Williamson called the Great Leveling. What happened during the Great Leveling, they say, was much broader than just a decline in the top income shares. Inequality diminished even within the middle and lower ranks. And the Great Leveling was not just a manifestation of government's redistribution from rich to poor with taxes and transfers. Incomes became more equal even before those taxes. Some of the equalization can be linked to the need to fight two world wars and the Great Depression. There was a sense of we're all in this together. It's hard to imagine that kind of solidarity today in the face of national and global threats like the pandemic and climate change. Maybe the closest today is support for Ukraine from all sides of the political spectrum. While the Great Leveling was slow, taking over half a century, the fall off was fast, largely occurring from 1980 to 2000. A number of writers have blamed baby boomers as selfish materialists. As a baby boomer, I think this is unfair. We were an activist generation engaged in efforts for civil rights, peace in Vietnam, and ecology. I think the change had more to do with structural issues, such as the decline of unions, the decreasing progressivity of federal income tax, and the increasing globalization of trade. And in the last 20 years, my personal view is that the power of elite forces like the Koch brothers, industry lobbyists, and conservative think tanks have continued to push this country toward privatization in the name of, quote, freedom. The more egalitarian era was also a time of high cross-party collaboration. 100 years ago, the political parties were often opposed, but in the 1940s to 60s, there was sometimes more division within parties than between them, for instance, between Southern and Northern Democrats. And the parties were not as tribal. Some studies have asked how people would feel about their child marrying someone from the other party. The Atlantic reports that in 1960, only 5% of respondents would be disturbed if that happened. By 2010, it was up to 40%. I didn't find more recent figures, but I can't imagine that the number hasn't shot up further since then. With so many on both sides feeling the opposition is not just wrong, but evil. This division may lead to Americans marrying, befriending, and living near people of the same party, which does nothing to break down stereotypes and fear. We see the decrease in social trust in surveys. In 1957, 77% of respondents said most people can be trusted. Now, again, those were probably white respondents, but still. By the 2010s, that number had fallen from 77 to 33%, and I'm sure it has not rebounded since. The decline of participation in social and civic groups that Putnam documented also reduces our chances of interacting with people different from us. He points out that the mid-20th century was a time of unprecedented flowering of civic and fraternal organizations, the NAACP, the Knights of Columbus, the Boy Scouts, the Rotary Club, Audubon Society, and so on. With fewer of us interacting in person, it's easier to self-select our community, especially online. Many of us belong to organizations that we support with a yearly donation, but we have no other involvement. And religious involvement parallels this decline with a rapid fall off in the 1960s and a precipitous plunge since 2000. Putnam says young Americans in particular came to view religion as judgmental, homophobic, hypocritical, and partisan. And they are not necessarily wrong. 35 to 40% of millennials say they have no religion. In their book, How Democracies Die, Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt state, when societies divide into partisan camps with profoundly different worldviews, and when those differences are viewed as existential and irreconcilable, Political rivalry can devolve into partisan hatred. Parties come to see each other not as legitimate rivals, but as dangerous enemies. Losing ceases to be an accepted part of the political process, but instead becomes a catastrophe. And we've seen a lot about this in the last couple of weeks. Now, since I'm here today to give us some reason for optimism, I'd like to single out Braver Angels and similar groups. Their mission is to bring together people of differing views to listen to each other and find common ground. A basic premise is that you must give up trying to change the other person's mind, and you must listen to them with respect. Now, sometimes people's minds do change. An amazing example of this is Daryl Davis, a Black musician who has spent years befriending members of the Ku Klux Klan one at a time. By taking the time to get to know them and to let them know him, he has led 200 men to leave that organization. One theory about the pendulum swing from the 1950s to today is backlash. Many people are all for progress and inclusion, but only up to a certain point. Putnam says, as the 1970s wore on, politicians increasingly understood that while white Americans could abide the slow, steady, and separate progress of Black Americans, when progress demanded a reorganization of power structures, reallocation of resources, reformation of cultural norms, and genuine integration, backlash would ensue. So school busing and integration was a dramatic example of this. And it seems that the election of Barack Obama increased a sense of threat among the white community clinging to its majority status. I don't think this is the exact quote, but there's something like, to people used to privilege, any sharing of that privilege looks like theft. Putnam asserts that during the great leveling, that is the earlier part of the 20th century, even though many options in housing, education, and careers were closed to Black citizens, they still made more gains toward overall equality than they have since 1970. Lest we become too righteous about this, we could consider the way that many UU churches say we want diverse membership, yet we expect our music, our food choices, and other traditions to remain as they are. We want diverse people as long as they act just like us. This is not a new phenomenon. And as someone mentioned yesterday, the dislike of those German immigrants coming in the middle of the 19th century with their beer and dancing. In fact, Benjamin Franklin expressed concern that the wave of new German immigrants would overwhelm the English traditions of the colonies. And politicians have forever exploited the fear of the other in order to get votes. And that's not just here. That was definitely a factor in Brexit. We've also seen several waves of backlash against the women's movement from the Phyllis Schlafly era to today's assault on reproductive rights. Now, I wrote this about a week ago, and it's literally today's assault now. Putnam finds that overall, women made and maintained more progress than Blacks, but the disproportionate effects of the pandemic on women's lives and careers have shown how fragile that success is. One source of optimism is the idealism of the young. Greta Thunberg started a youth movement to save the planet. The upper middle class survivors of the Parkland shooting made common cause with inner city youth who see killings regularly. They astoundingly achieved gun legislation in Florida that is now one of the strongest in any conservative state. And they mobilized for events like the March for Our Lives. Young people who have grown up with the internet generally have a more cosmopolitan view of the world, more openness to people who don't look like them, talk like them, or dress like them. They have more fluid notions of gender and race, or reject those categories entirely. Putnam understands the divisive qualities of the online world, but also says, unlike the reformers of a bygone era, today we have vastly more tools and resources. So we can find out about someone like Greta Thunberg because of the internet. Does anyone doubt that without cell phones, none of the recent trials of police for brutality and murder would have even happened? Putnam concludes, the lessons of history are two-sided. Once before, Americans have gotten ourselves out of a mess like the one we're in now. But we also learned that in that first progressive era, we didn't take seriously enough the challenge of full inclusion. The question we face today is not whether we can or should turn back the tide of history, but whether we can resurrect the early communitarian virtues in a way that does not reverse the progress of individual liberties. So now I'd like to hear from you about communities that have been important to you in your life or that you participate in now. Communities don't have to be in themselves about saving the world. Maybe you have breakfast once a week with old friends. Maybe you volunteer in your kid's school. Maybe you participate in highway cleanup or community theater, a local choir or band. So please share with us any thoughts on the topic and what communities are meaningful to you. A young couple at Prairie had recently maybe bought a house in a neighborhood in Madison that was quite varied in background and income. And I think during the pandemic, she said, I'm going to do something about this. And she put notices in people's mailboxes or put notices up inviting people to, they had food out on their driveway, an event. She kind of created a neighborhood organization of people who wouldn't necessarily get to know each other. But it takes something to start that. Yeah, one of the benefits about being organized into an official church is that it gives you a certain credibility. If your group wants to participate with other groups, they don't have to know exactly what we do in here. We found that at Prairie, we did work for some time, all this changed with the pandemic, but for instance, programs that did breakfasts or dinners for the homeless and so on, that churches took turns doing this, and our group would be there with someone from the Lutherans or whoever was doing it that week. So there are some opportunities that as an individual you might not have, but it gives you a sort of cover for that. International commentators have talked about the two-party system, which is not as common in other democracies, and the problems that that causes with extremes, and even the fact that any particular policy can just go back and forth every time you get a new government in. And I actually have two things for the closing words. Theodore Roosevelt said, the fundamental rule of our national life, the rule which underlies all others, is that on the whole and in the long run, we shall go up or down together. And then the last thing from a hymn that I later thought maybe I should have picked, it's in our hymnal called Love Will Guide Us. And the second verse says, if you cannot sing like angels, if you cannot speak before thousands, you can give from deep within you, you can change the world with your love.